Howdy, that's our movie. There's some flyers on the desk there you can take as you leave. My website is hammernews.com. And there's microphones on either side there if you want to ask any questions about the movie. I didn't personally make the movie, although I should have. I'd have better music for it. Or about press coverage or the war or politics or the recently deceased election, feel free to hop up on the microphones and ask something. I was a reporter in Russia too for 2 years when the empire collapsed from 91 to 94, and went there actually to do a documentary on German reunification, and I had a side trip to Russia, and as it went on, what was going on in Russia was so much more overwhelming than what was happening in Germany. I went for 2 weeks and ended up staying for 2 years, and wrote for every paper there, really every English language paper: Moscow News, Moscow Tribune, Moscow Guardian, Wimui, Moscow Times. And within 2 months of my arrival, the Soviet Union had collapsed and broken up into 14 republics. Yeltsin had thrown out Gorbachev on Christmas Day out of his office in the Kremlin, taken over the country, which was now Russia. The flag had changed, the hammer and sickle came down. They freed prices, which instantly went up fourfold and 26-fold by the end of the year. I was kidnapped at gunpoint by mafia guys and driven in the woods and almost killed. And Russia was maybe the cheapest place in the world then, because the people made $8 a month, and that could buy about $800. It's about 100-to-1 factor in what you wanted to buy. Many things you couldn't buy. You had to wait 6 weeks to try to buy something like toilet paper, just keep looking and looking, or buy it in a Western store where it was 4 times the Western price. So it's like a 400-fold price differential between a local product and a Western product. And that was a world that was totally disintegrating, because within a few weeks, pretty much everything they had made, they had basically created an alternative universe, and it was just dissolving. And I went there sort of like Kevin Costner does in Dancing with Elves. And I wanted to see the East before it was gone. And it was going really, really quickly. And it was very sad, because the communist system was, incredibly evil and brutal, but it also had provided a lot of things for a lot of people, and it was just breaking up and leaving nothing in its wake. The mafia ended up taking over pretty much the whole country. They run Russia as much as Putin does, or any government does, and what's happened there in the press is very, very sad. It's Putin shut down almost every single independent media in the country, and Bush hasn't made one little peep about it. The big oligarchs, these 7 big billionaires who had pillaged and robbed and built these gigantic empires, have been waged war on by Putin. The thing was, they ran different networks, different TV networks and magazines and papers, and every single one of them was shut down and controlled by Putin, to where there's really no independent voice left except the Moscow Times that dares criticize him, and he just passed the thing where the Federation governors who were elected are now appointed, and his Duma, his Congress, which is predominantly his party, just rammed that through. So another bit of democracy has faded away and pretty much is returning to its authoritarian roots, and it's very sad, because Yeltsin appointed him because Yeltsin was under threat of going to jail for his various alleged crimes too, or his political opponents. So he got some, tough guy, KGB weasel, and he sort of showed his stripes. But the Palestine Hotel thing was pretty amazing footage in that. I just read the CPJ. Committee to Protect Journalists report on that, and it's pretty damning video. It looks like they're just targeted in on that thing, and of course what they were doing was supposedly they had been under attack from insurgents, and a couple of tank guys were actually wounded, standing in the open hatch. And they claimed there was a forward observer, somebody targeting fire on them. Of course, what they see at the Palestine Hotel is binoculars, is a reflection of binoculars and camera lenses, because it's all journalists, because every single balcony has cameras. Now, you know, it's like one thing to say, oh yeah, there's an observer, but it's like when there's 50 of them, you go, maybe that's the big hotel that has the journalist in it. And they claimed, they just lied and said there was fire, and there was no fire. You could see that in every single person there says there was no fire coming from anywhere around that hotel. They just saw the reflections, and this guy fired in the tank. And apparently, as the commander of the tank battalion, got on the radio right away, and was just screaming. I was like, "Who the fuck fired at the Palestine Hotel? And damn it! I told you, who did that?" And drove right down and met with him. And of course, he was never punished, and nobody's really ever punished for any of the terrible mistakes. The Providence Journal just had a pretty good long story about the friendly fire thing of Pat Tillman. Because these things seem to happen a lot more and more because the insurgents aren't very good at hitting people except with bombs. And it's interesting because they're doing some of the things in Iraq that actually, they're actually coming out in the open now. It's not just a pure insurgency. They're dancing in the streets and stuff, and that's changed a lot from when they were just sort of hiding and just barely surviving. I don't see anything really good happening in Iraq. I almost think it's this violence and the deaths and things that are just going to increase exponentially, because it just seems like it's just growing and growing. And I think actually, even the neocons are beginning to see the folly of their pursuit, and we may see Bush pulling out next year, I suspect, of Iraq. And then, of course, it'll break down into a hellish civil war. I wrote an article about that a year ago, because the Shiites vastly outnumber the Sunnis. They always talk about the Sunnis, but they always include the Kurds, but the Kurds were never part of any ruling coalition. So the numbers are actually something like 60-something percent to about 17%. So it's a 4-to-1 advantage the Shiites have. And they were kept down like animals for 80 years by the ruling Sunnis, who were basically this little group from Tikrit that the British had all appointed in the 20s. And the British, incredibly, said the exact same phrases Bush is doing. Exact same. We're not coming here to conquer you. We're coming here to liberate you. When we've created peace and tranquility in Iraq, it'll be a mecca for the entire Middle East. It'll be an example for the whole Middle East. They had a lot of the same kind of notions, and they only subdued Iraq by basically annihilating a few towns and killing 5,000 people or something when the uprising happened. And as I thought, when this whole misbegotten adventure started, we're going to find out why Saddam is such a monster. Supposedly the Iraqis are, just love to fight about everything, and they can never agree to anything, and they factionalize over every single little thing. And we don't have experience in the Middle East, and we don't know how to run anything there. And if there was any chance for any successful outcome, it was evaporated when Bush just let the place be looted, which is incredible, because these neocons, every single State Department, the military, the Pentagon, they all had plans for this invasion. Then you come in with MPs, you control the thing. And there was some kind of lunatic idea that, well, it's good to let them blow off some steam and just go crazy and destroy the country. And it's like, but it was our country now. And they didn't really care.
Excuse me, before I leave, I thought reporters are supposed to report. You're full of a lot of opinions tonight.
I'm a commentator.
Oh, you're a commentator. Yeah. Okay, sorry.
but the I mean, what the way it was done was insanely poor, and I don't think there's anybody that doesn't believe that, even the most extreme conservatives. And I think we really should be very afraid about this, because the way this war started, I mean, the thing I really remember was Martin Scorsese in the Oscars when Moore was giving a speech, and they had the camera on him, and he was just like a little rabbit, and he was afraid to even move, and he was afraid to clap or even show any kind of, you know, appreciation. Of course, he's a pretty big liberal, and I just thought, boy, you know, this kind of like level of fear and of intimidation is something that I really haven't ever seen. And you know, Bush is purging any element that dared criticize him. The CIA now is like has 10 people quit because Portergas's aide is apparently some, you know, raving neocon and just abusing and treating people really badly. And these are the guys that are going to catch, you know, the Al-Qaeda people before they attack us, and they're quitting. The guy appointed to the head of the Justice Department is the most slavish sycophant I've ever seen, Gonzalez. He's a guy that I think, you know, would prosecute anybody Bush just said. So, you know, go after him. Okay, we'll find something. And the Democrats didn't even try to oppose it. They're holding their fire for the senatorial, the Supreme Court nominees. And I think it's very chilling that they didn't try to stop him, because of course he's one of the guys Bush wants to put on the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court probably will have 3 or 4 vacancies that Bush can appoint now, because they're going to quit in droves. And the thing to really watch for, what they're going to try to do, is overturn the filibuster rule. And people said, oh, well, they can't do it, it'd need a congressional amendment and stuff. But they do, the way they do it is just by rules changes, by saying, well, instead of somebody being able to talk for 40 hours or so, or 20 hours, each person can only talk for 2 hours. And the Democrats wouldn't have enough people to keep a filibuster going. So chances are they're going to be able to break the filibusters and ram through whoever they want on the Supreme Court. And, you know, then that's the third branch of government that's now gone into sort of the extreme right wing, and it's a very chilling situation. I mean, I've seen speakers say, oh, you know, we've got to learn to get along, and now we've got to move to the right, and we've got to, you know, understand the red states and stuff, and I don't think so. I mean, I think we have to fight. I think we have to really resist this, because it's very, very intimidating, because you know, the idea that George Bush is a really moral guy and a decent guy and a good guy and a trustworthy guy, I think this was the most cynical, outrageous war I've ever seen. I am not opposed. I'm not a peacenik at all. I'm not, I think Iran was our enemy and we were justified in trying to overthrow the mullahs, which, you know, had been killing Americans for 20 years, 25 years. But Saddam was in a box. Saddam wasn't a threat. Saddam was there was no reason in the world to go after Saddam in this business that everybody knew he had weapons of mass destruction is baloney. The UN did really good work. They did clean it out, and Saddam did clean it out apparently, just because he got tired of being pestered by all of the people. And it's amazing, because when the war all happened, I was sure they would find something. They would find something, because, you know, Bush would have some little group burying a little nuclear lab in the desert, in the dust. But he didn't even think he had to do that. He didn't even think, you know, they thought he could pretty much keep lying forever. And this election has validated that. And the rest of the world looks at America, I think, like we're crazy. And it's a good question. Are we crazy? I mean, our economy is hanging by a thread here. If anybody, any of the countries, now, you know who owns our debt now? Mainland China, right behind Japan. They're the ones buying our bonds. They're the ones funding the $400 or $500 trillion deficits that Bush is ringing up. And all that has to happen for real economic collapse to happen is not that they, you know, sell our bonds. No, forget that. All they have to do is not buy them anymore. Buy euro bonds, and the dollar is now at the lowest point it's ever been again, back where it was in January, where I was going to write an article about the debt bomb, and now it's dropping. I don't want to go to Europe, so that's real good timing. And that's just something that's, you know, because you can't string this stuff out forever. You know, everybody buys our bonds because we're stable. Well, you know what? We're not stable anymore. He's running these $400 or $500 billion deficits forever, and giving more, wanting to give more and bigger tax cuts. You know, we went from the biggest surpluses to the biggest deficits in 3 years, which is unbelievable, and it's gonna be really bad. But mostly, you know, what he's done is turn the one-fourth of the world against us. One-fourth of, well, the Muslim world, certainly, but even the rest of the world. I mean, I talk to people and they're in cafes in Netherlands, and you know, somebody walks by and says, oh, are you American? He says, yes. And the guy picks up the drink and throws it in his face. You know, a lot of people hate us because of this stupid war and this you know, this incredible arrogance that they've treated everybody with. You're with us or against us. You know, and I mean, it was interesting because in the very beginning, Bush did some interesting things. He went to mosque. He seemed to be, you know, doing the sort of right thing, saying, well, it isn't a war on Muslims. You know, it's a war on Al-Qaeda. And then they, let me do a test. How many of you guys know what the Project for a New American Century is? Nobody? The Project for a New American Century is, was this group of pretty much everybody who's in the government. Rumsfeld, Cheney, Wolfowitz, I think Rice was part of it too, Douglas Fife. And it was pretty much as a battle plan for Iraq. It's an entire layout of how we should spread American values by the gun throughout the Middle East and you know, take over these countries, because we need a stable platform, we need a secure source of oil. And an incredible, it's on the web. You look it up on the web, I think it's still on there. You know, unbelievable, the arrogance of these people. And they actually say, of course, that would politically be impossible absent some enormous, catastrophic, provocative event. And then 9/11 happened, and they had their event, and they were off to the races. And so this was all, you know, laid out, planned, and everything to go into Iraq. This was, you know, they had their ideas that this was a good thing to do because we need a stable base. Somehow Saudi Arabia became too unstable because, you know, the sheiks weren't helping us catch the terrorists or something, and they thought Iraq was going to be better. It's breathtaking, and the reasons, and I believe a lot of this was edible, purely edible. George Bush was the black sheep. He was the ex-drunk. He was the you know, the one in the family who, you know, the father didn't respect very much. Jeb was supposed to become president, and he was going to finish the job, and he's going to show his daddy up. I'm a better man than you are, you know. And the only person who's ever said that besides me is Maureen Dowd, bless her heart. And nobody else is talking about it. It's so obvious. It's screechingly, horribly obvious that that's the case. And then there's another thing thrown in. Saddam supposedly tried to kill George Bush I. I asked James Baker about that when I was a reporter in Moscow. And then Clinton sent some cruise missiles over to Iraq. So he could also go, look, you know, look, Daddy, I outdid you. I'm a better man than you. And I protected you, because I caught the guy who tried to kill you. Although even there's some question about that might have been some fabrication of the Kuwait intelligence service, the plot on George Bush I, you know, sort of like the Mohammed Atta in Prague thing that, you know, was up and down and up and down. But now we're faced with, you know, the immediate things is really Iran. And I'm pretty surprised that Israel hasn't blown up their nuclear plants. which is something I think just shouldn't be allowed to happen, because Iran is just, you know, they're really, the mullahs are extremely evil people in Iran, and connected, you know, through the terror, through all different terrorists for 25 years, and they just shouldn't be allowed to make nuclear weapons. Just blanket and no, you know, pretty much the same thing as Kim Jong-il, although that's been, that's too late. It's too late to deal with North Korea. And it was interesting because you had to say, well, you know, Clinton dropped the ball and he did this agreed framework, whatever the hell this bizarre phrase was, and the agreement to whatever. But actually, they didn't. They followed what the agreement was with Clinton. They actually reprocessed something else. I think they were talking, let's see, I think it was about plutonium that the agreement was, and they went and built a whole little plant in some mountain and did uranium instead. So they actually technically followed the agreement. But now supposedly we can't do anything because they have maybe one bomb, maybe two, maybe three, maybe five, who knows. At that, you know, that's a very, very bad situation, because it turns out they have been sharing the stuff with Pakistan, and it's a place where 20 out of 22 million, maybe 2 million people were allowed to starve because this maniac wouldn't open his country to the West or the rest of the world, while he would have these, you know, 100,000 person Olympic-like festivals in the stadium to entertain guests. You know, his countrymen were eating grass and cardboard and dying in their sheds, and if they went out foraging for food, they were arrested, and so they're all fleeing to China, and China is supplying them with everything. I mean, it's the only lifeline they have, the oil and gas, and that's why they agreed to deal with stuff, because Bush pressured China to intercede in it, and the North Koreans said, oh, no, you know, screw you, and the Chinese shut off their oil for about 3 days. And the North Koreans then came to the table. But I think, you know, the Iranians must be laughing their heads off at Iraq, and so must bin Laden. I mean, you know, there could be nothing in the world more encouraging to bin Laden than you know, this intractable, miserable, horrible pit, you know, of being caught in Iraq, because it's draining all of our resources. We can't respond to any other threat. The military is going to be decimated because all these poor slobs who have been, you know, drafted basically and then forced, you know, re-upped, you know, constant stop-loss stuff over and over again. They've had their contracts violated. And they're going to quit in mass when they come back, because it's obvious, you know, that you can't really trust the military anymore. You can't trust the government, and we may get to a point where, you know, might actually need a draft if he wants to stay in Iraq, and if anything else happens. So it almost looks in a long-term way like, you know, 2000 was it. You know, millennium might have been the zenith for the American Empire, and this is the beginning of some long, slow decline, because the amount of loss we've suffered in, you know, the economy and our self-respect and our position in the world, and our strength at home and militarily and economically is staggering in the last 4 years. You know, people just voted to send the guy back to do it again. So, if you got any ideas on that, I'd like to know how. And the really frightening thing is, we'll never know what happened in this last election. We will never know. Because, for all we know, Kerry did win. In Ohio, the Congress of Ohio completely redistricted almost all the precincts, and they consolidated precincts in you know, say two or three into one place, and they didn't give them more machines. They thought, well, they had these electronic machines, but the electronic machines didn't come through. Most of the things were all these punch cards again, and so there were these insane lines averaging hour and a half, 2 hours, just the minimum, and up to 10 hours in universities and 8 hours in inner city areas and black areas. Would you wait 8 hours to vote? I certainly wouldn't, and neither did the people there. So what happened is maybe 100,000 went home rather than vote. People were in line waiting forever. They called their friends on cell phone and said, don't come, don't bother, it's impossible. And so we'll never know how many people didn't vote. And that was engineered. In the inner city areas in Columbus, they had less machines on election day than they had in the primary. And in the primary, you know, maybe one third as many people voted. So it was an absolute outrage that happened. And they changed the rules. The last election, if you voted in a different precinct, your vote would count. But because they've changed all the precincts and redistricted them or reconsolidated them, now they changed the rule. The black Secretary of State, who was, you know, a Clarence Thomas Bush clone, and, mind you, also the co-manager of George Bush's campaign in Ohio. Again, the guy that's controlling the votes and the counting and the whole system is Bush's campaign manager, just like Catherine Harris. And he, they sued to do a number of things to prevent votes from counting, from not allowing them to be cast in a different precinct. In Columbus, where the biggest, hugest weights were, and which was, you know, a big university town, like Ohio State, and maybe University of Ohio is there too. I don't know. They surrounded the central election headquarters with buses and police, a cordon almost of police, and that was the only place you could vote and be sure your vote was counted if you didn't know where you were supposed to vote in a provisional ballot. And of course, with that, you know, that kind of thing, geez, you know, a lot of people wouldn't feel comfortable going into the building, you know, with that kind of a situation. The provisional ballots were counted. I actually haven't paid any attention to it in the last week. I was interviewing a guy in Columbus who has a award-winning reporter there, and they counted the 155,000 provisional ballots. I guess that was what the vote change was from 136,000 Bush lead to 119,000 that they're claiming is the final thing. But there's also 92,000 votes that were rejected. You know, like the torn or double punched or the hanging chad stuff in Florida. And those votes are going to be counted because the Greens and the Libertarians sued to do it. And the Democrats came up with the money. They had to pay a lot of money. DNC finally did. And so they're going to count those. But of course, they're going to take their sweet time. He'll probably wait till Bush is re-inaugurated and do it in February. But if it had been done fairly, you know, who knows? 136,000 isn't a huge number. It was a huge number with a partisan Secretary of State to ever overcome, and that's why Kerry quit and didn't try to contest it. That and the fact that Bush got 3.5 million lead. But I'll tell you, we'll never know what happened because the 30% of the country voted with electronic machines that had no paper trail. No paper in the machine, no paper spit out, no record, no recount possible, nothing, nada, zilch. And every one of those companies, the four big companies that made them, is run by big Republican groups with intimate connections to Bush. And there, people have to check the software and stuff, say that it's garbage. It's easily hackable by any computer person. You could just change the chip in the thing. You could pull out the chip and plug in another chip that changed the numbers and then do it and reverse it or something. And once it goes into the central thing, there's no real record of it. It's just all added into the total. And, you know, the idea was, oh, well, it was good, easy for elderly and people with handicaps to vote. But it was a real nightmare. It basically allowed the most incredible thefts possible. The first time these machines were used was 2002. And one of the machines, one of the companies was run by Chuck Hagel. Chuck Hagel is now a U.S. Senator from Nebraska. He was president of the company that made the voting machines. And he won with the biggest percentage ever achieved by anybody
in Nebraska. And he made the machines. And nobody thought there was something wrong with that. In Georgia, both Max Cleland, the triple amputee war veteran who was attacked and trashed as a coward and a wimp because he didn't, you know, support the Iraq War, a guy who lost three limbs in Vietnam, was ahead by something like 5 to 8 points. And so was, I think, the governor, the Democratic governor, Sonny Perdue, and both lost to the Republicans by 5 or 8 points. Something like a 10 to 15 point vote swing from expected and exit polls. And guess what? Georgia had 100% computer voting machines. It was the first place that did that. And surprise, you know? So when people ask me, you know, 6 months ago, who's gonna win the election, I said, you know, I mean, with deep illness in my heart, I said, I think the election may be already over and George Bush has won. Because if you make the voting machines, you can make them do anything. And when there's no record and no paper, and it was very simple. One of the companies had a printer on it, you know, and Nevada and some places forced them. There were all these suits to stop these machines, and about 10 states or 12 states, Ben and Jerry did this thing, Moral Majority, what was it? What was the name of it? True Majority, something. And they did real good work, and they got this up behind up in front of a lot of state legislators, and a lot of them banned those machines. And every time they came up to it before any court, they said, oh, this is terrible. Yes, these are horrible. You could steal an election with these machines. Well, then you have to replace them all by 2005 or 2006. And so they allowed them all to be used in this election. And so, you know, it's not only the most important election. I was afraid, you know, there's a chance it may be the last election because we're, you know, terrorists that are going to hit us at some point. And with this president and this Congress and this Supreme Court, we're going to have big problems. So does anybody have any questions? Microphone. For the vast other bulk of people. You should have gotten up before. I would have shut up.
Now that all these lies about weapons of mass destruction, et cetera, are out, what's being done about them? I mean,
nothing. It seems Bush is, you know, Bush basically has seen you can fool most of the people most of the time, and there's no penalty for it. And the people reelected him, so apparently they didn't really care. But mostly it was the propaganda worked, and that's what Kerry didn't seem to understand, that people had bought it. They believed that Saddam was part of 9/11. They believed he was linked to Osama, and it was madness. Even though, you know, it's completely, and so what, 40% of the country, you know, believed it. And that was the heart of the people that voted for Bush. And they believed it because George Bush and Cheney and where everybody repeated it 100 times, again and again and again. And every time they repeated it, the networks should have put on some expert saying, well, yes, but that's just not true because there was no link. Saddam, the CIA got Osama's cell phone records. It was a while ago, 98, I think, 98, 97. It had 1,000 calls Osama bin Laden made. You know how many of them went to Iraq? Guess. Zero. None. Not one. And, you know, these things were all known. So, but they allowed them to say this again and again, and you know, no reporter ever said, excuse me, Mr. Vice President, excuse me, isn't that a lie, sir? Isn't that untrue? And that's what had to be said, and that's what John Kerry had to do. And Kerry was afraid to use the war word. I was trying to tell, you know, I know McCurry from a couple of times I've met, and I was sending him things on that. I said, you know, you have to use the word. You have to be like a prosecutor saying, you lied, sir. You got us in a war. You lied about this. And he could have, I think he could have, Bush was on his heels in that first debate, and I think he could have knocked him out of the box had he done that. He says, well, I know that. I know Saddam attacked us, or Osama attacked us. And Kerry could have said, you know, it's like, well, then why did you lie about it? Why did you tell the people 100 times that Osama and Saddam are linked? You know, how can we trust you when you never tell the truth? And I think Bush would have cracked like an egg. You know, I think he would have reserved it as some kind of adolescent schoolyard thing and basically just, you know, committed suicide on television. And, you know, that's what he had to do because he allowed Bush to trash him for 2 months. And everybody knew this was coming. You know, this Karl Rove isn't so much a political mastermind as a very skillful character assassin. Every single candidate from Texas on, he had a timeline on how he was going to destroy them and smear them. And, of course, would go after the strengths. And so Kerry comes out and does this, you know, a Vietnam veteran, I'm reporting for duty, sir. It's like, okay, we know you're in Vietnam, thanks, you know. He says that 8,000 times. And, of course, Bush has got to go after Vietnam. So he has these Swift boat guys, and I knew they were in the dock. I read in July or June that they, you know, it was all 10 former commanders had said Kerry is unfit for service. And I said, what? And then you look at it closer, and it's like, two of these guys campaigned with Kerry in 96. How does this happen? Well, money. You know, Rove's friends paid him hundreds of thousands of dollars. And if anybody enterprising had dug into these guys' finances, they were discredited. But they were discredited after they had told the story on all the networks for 2 or 3 weeks. And the damage was done. You know, whatever Kerry's respect for Kerry's war record and his military service had evaporated, had become neutral. And a guy, essentially, who deserted, because he took off for 10 or 12 months in Alabama and never just didn't show up. I mean, you go to jail for that. My friend, I said, well, you know, yeah, you went AWOL. And this friend who was in Vietnam is saying, no, he didn't go AWOL. AWOL is when you get drunk and you don't show up over a weekend. He deserted. And a deserter smeared a decorated war veteran successfully and got away with it. And that's a terrible, shameful thing that was allowed to happen. And then the other, you know, like one of those guys in the Swift boat group was a guy who'd given Kerry his medals. You know, another one of them had campaigned with him and stood on a stage and saying, yeah, he's my best friend, he's a great candidate, blah, 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 in 96 and before. And how do they change? Well, you know, their book was number one or number two on the bestseller list. They got paid on a lot of these appearances. They made millions and millions of dollars from this stuff. And, you know, people will do a lot of things for millions and millions of dollars. And it was really, really shabby because he knew this was coming and Kerry didn't touch Bush at all in the Democratic convention and for the next month or so. I just didn't touch him at all and it was, you know, it was obvious that the Republicans were gonna have a hate fest and just, you know, just trash him. And Zell Miller did some real, you know, yeoman work for them in that convention. That was really pretty incredible. I mean, you know, if Dean was destroyed for his scream, Miller should have been sent away for a long, long vacation in a straitjacket for that. And it was really amazing. But, you know, the most interesting thing about the election was that Perry people were confident. They thought they were going to win. All the exit polls say they're going to win. In Ukraine, they're doing the election again. In this mafia-ridden nightmare country where you know, the mafia runs everything and the ex-president Kuchma was supposedly on tape ordering some reporter's head cut off, which personally offends me, they're doing the election over again. Why? Because the guy who won by 3 points. But the exit poll said the other guy was going to win by 3 points. Does that sound like something familiar to you? you know, the same numbers that happened here. The poll said Kerry was going to win by 3 points. And of this vast 3.5 million, Bush did better everywhere. But I think Kerry, you know, just didn't get it. He didn't get it. The whole thing was about toughness.
This whole election was about toughness. And Bush is a fake. He's not a tough guy. He's a bully, and he's a ideologue, and he's a stupid man, and he's not a really tough guy. And Kerry had to really prove that, and he had to prove that by kicking Bush around. And he wouldn't do that. He tried to talk to the best in America, and you know, there are people were saying, "Oh no, we can't do that. Our, you know, our negatives are too high." And it's like, well, your negatives are going to be a lot lower if you don't show the courage to call you know, somebody who lies as consistently as Bush a liar. And in my experience in politics, looking at politics for 40 years or so, well, you know, even as a little kid, I've never seen anybody as big a liar as George Bush. And the idea that everybody thinks he's so moral, I'm not even sure if all this religious stuff is serious. You know, everybody says, "Well, we can't dispute this. He's born again, and he's deeply devout, and he's, you know, he has this deep faith." And I don't know that he didn't look at this stuff with Lee Atwater and go, "You know, if we get these people, if we can like co-opt these people and get this."